Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. While you're there, rate and review us. We're trying to bring you the best in cutting-edge libertarian conversation about politics, culture, and ideas. Today, we are talking with Reason's own criminal justice reporter, C.J. Ciaramella, and we're going to be talking about asset forfeiture, civil asset forfeiture, which is a very, very hot topic these days for a couple of reasons we'll get into. C.J., thanks for talking to us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk first about what is civil asset forfeiture. This is a topic that you've covered a lot. You wrote a great story about how Mississippi, kind of on a statewide level, is out of control. Places like the Institute for Justice, the great libertarian public interest law firm, has been going after this as well. But most recently, Donald Trump, in a conversation with a gentleman who's about to become the head of, I guess, the County Sheriff's Association around the country, the gentleman said, you know, there's this Texas state senator. I don't want to name who they are, but, you know, they want to reform civil asset laws, civil asset forfeiture laws. And Trump was like, can you believe that? It's like, tell me their name. Let's destroy their career. So as a starting point, tell us what civil asset forfeiture law is.
Well, civil asset forfeiture is basically a legal process by which police and prosecutors can seize someone's property if they have suspicion that the property was either paid for with illicit proceeds or was involved in the commission of a crime itself. So basically, if you're driving in a car and you have weed on you and a cop pulls you over on the interstate and they find weed in your car, they can seize your car because it was involved in the transportation of drugs, or they think that you're a drug dealer and that you buy your car with drug proceeds. It's actually been around for a long time. The first civil asset, this goes back to common law. But some of the first civil asset forfeiture laws were actually created to fight pirates and basically take pirates' ill-gotten goods. And that's sort of always been the legal fiction behind asset forfeiture, is that you use it to take the illegal proceeds of criminals to sort of hamper their criminal enterprises and keep them from getting rich off of their illicit activity.
Right. And there is a kind of fascinating, it's not quite medieval, but it's pretty close mentality behind some of this, because when the cops or the law enforcement agency actually goes after the asset, they charge the asset, right? It isn't the owner. They don't say, oh, CJ, you know, you were driving in this Corvette, which you obviously bought with money from being a drug dealer. They actually charge the Corvette and take it.
Yeah, that's right. And if you look up asset forfeiture cases, they're never Commonwealth of Pennsylvania v. Jones. They're things like Commonwealth of Pennsylvania v. one Toyota Corolla, or v. an at like 365 Oak Street. They're against houses and cars.
Yeah, or specific amounts of cash,
yeah.
Things. So you were mentioning, the example that immediately came to mind in explaining it in contemporary America had to do with, you're driving in car with a bag of weed. The car is guilty of helping you transport your weed. From my understanding, civil asset forfeiture really went on steroids, because it is this old common law tradition going back centuries. But it really got ramped up in the 80s during the roiding out of the war on drugs. Is that where a lot of the laws that are being used now come from?
Yeah, the DOJ, the sort of current asset forfeiture guidelines, and the way DOJ handle, or Justice Department, excuse me, handles a lot of this came about in the 80s in response to, you know, these public fears about drug trafficking and cartels and things like that. Asset forfeiture was supposed to, the FBI says it's a way to sort of defang these cartels.
Right. Because, on a certain level, and, you know, giving law enforcement the benefit of the doubt, some of this is, I mean, it's like a Miami Vice plot, right? Where it's like, you know, these huge, immense drug lords who have amassed gigantic houses, cigarette boats, you know, hot and cold running blondes, nightclubs, et cetera. This was a way, kind of like the way the RICO statutes were earlier in the 70s, a way of going after the mafia. This is the way to just kind of take away the wealth and destroy them.
Right. I mean, and in a way it makes sense, because, I mean, imagine if you're a police officer and you pull over a guy who has a bag of weed in his car, but he also has $50,000 stashed in the gas tank. You know, you can't really charge him with anything, even if you suspect he's probably, you know, trafficking in large amounts of drugs or money. You know, so it was frustrating on one hand for cops. The problem is that they apply this to people who are obviously not drug dealers. You know, they'll do this to people for petty amounts of cash, a lot less than $50,000. They do this to people who have just a couple hundred bucks on them. If they find weed in their car, they'll take their cash and say that's drug proceeds.
And I think you wrote about, I mean, cases. I mean, there is a massive amount of abuse going on, and some of the specific cases are madness, rage-inducing. A couple in Philadelphia, I believe it was in 2014, where their kid got busted for having $40 of heroin in, you know, and he was living in their house. The cops arrest the kid, and then they come back and they arrest the house, essentially, because they're saying it facilitated the kid's heroin, you know, whatever, possession or intent to sell. And the parents, you know, didn't even know the kid was a junkie, right?
Yeah, no, they said they had no knowledge of their son's drug use or anything like that. But then when he got arrested, they went there by court order. They had to drop him off at a rehab facility or something. And when they came back, they found that the cops were basically locking them out of their own house and saying that they were seizing their house. And when it got a bunch of media coverage, the Philly DA eventually backed off and they got their house back. But it was a huge nightmare for them.
And they were. Yeah, and in you wrote a great piece not long ago for Reason. It's online at reason.com about kind of the state of Mississippi's asset forfeiture, complex. I mean, talk a little bit about what you found in that story and how widespread this is, and also how difficult it is to know the exact numbers of assets, of property and cash. And in one case, you read about even couches, furniture being seized. Talk about that in terms of Mississippi and the difficulty in getting good data on just how many police departments are doing this and for how much money.
Yeah, and it's one of the more frustrating things about looking into this is that it's hard to actually get a handle on how much police are actually seizing. In Mississippi, they have basically no reporting or tracking requirements for asset forfeiture to, you know, track how much stuff police are actually seizing. But a state task force studying the issue managed to get a bunch of court records and data from the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics, which works with local Mississippi agencies on asset forfeiture and drug busts and things like that. So we got a chance to actually look through all of these cases, and you know, there were a lot of big sort of busts, like I was talking about, where they find hundreds of thousands of dollars. But all throughout these documents, I found cases where they are taking, like, I found one where it was $70. They took $70 in a guy's truck for misdemeanor drug possession. The worst one I found, which is one you mentioned, is they seized a woman's furniture, including the pictures off the wall, lamps, and a couch, because they suspected her boyfriend was a drug dealer. And she had to go to court. She challenged this in court, which is, you know, the only way you can do this, you have to file a complaint, and it costs you money, and you have to pay a lawyer. Because remember, civil asset forfeiture is civil, not criminal. So you don't have a right to a public defender.
Yeah, and you quote a guy in the story who says, you know, I guess a lawyer who says, you know, when people come to me and say, hey, I want to contest this, he's like, don't bother, because, I mean, just on a basic cost-benefit analysis, it's almost always the case that you will spend more money getting back your junk than if you just kind of let it go.
No, and this is the system. The main complaint that you'll see from the Institute for Justice and a lot of the groups challenging this is the system is so heavily weighted in favor of the state that it makes it completely impractical to actually challenge a lot of these petty seizures. So for everyone that you see where someone actually challenged it and got something back, you don't even know how many where something was seized and they just let it go because they didn't want to have, you know, they already went through all this terrible process and now they have to try and go through more and pay more money just to get, you know, $70 or a car that's probably worth $1,500 back.
Yeah. And also, if I'm recalling correctly from an Institute for Justice study, they looked at in a place like Mississippi, the law enforcement agency or the group that seizes the asset gets to keep about 80% of the value. But in something like 26 states, a majority of states, they get to keep 100% of what they get. How does that affect? I mean, talk a little bit about the incentive that builds into law enforcement. That is, kind of scary.
Yeah, it's a perverse profit incentive is what the Institute for Justice and other groups argue. And you know, the police like to say that, you know, this is a tool they use and that they're on the up and up. But when you look at these petty seizures, it's really hard to argue in some of these cases. Like the couch case, they actually cut a deal with this lady and gave her back everything but the couch. They actually kept her couch.
It must have been a fold out or a sleeper or something then, or a really big sectional.
Yeah, it was a white couch. So maybe it was nice. But you see this, and there was a conference with a bunch of law enforcement guys, and we got video of it. This was, I think, in New Mexico, and they were all talking about asset forfeiture. And this one, I think it was a district attorney or a prosecutor, was talking about what they look for. And he says, you know, when they see a guy in a Mercedes coming out of a bar, they just salivate. They often go after big screen TVs and PlayStations and things like that, electronics, phones. In one of the Mississippi cases, they seized a guy's comic book collection.
Now, one of the reasons we're talking about this right now, or actually, I guess there's two reasons, right? One is that there is a broad-based bipartisan movement to reform civil asset forfeiture. Where is that coming from? And then secondly, where is the pushback on the reform coming from?
Well, the momentum really started building for this a few years ago. It was always sort of bubbling under the surface. I know Reason Magazine has been writing about it for a while. But starting a few years ago, the Washington Post did a really big investigative series on highway stops where police were seizing petty amounts of cash from people without charging them with any crime. And that's the other thing. Police don't even have to charge you with a crime to seize your stuff. But then there was a large New Yorker piece, and as some of these lawsuits started to ramp up and more media attention started to get paid to it, you saw legislatures start to pay more attention because they were getting, you know, calls from constituents or seeing some of these media reports or people within their districts were complaining to them. So you saw this sort of broad coalition of civil libertarians and constitutional-minded conservatives who really care about property rights, along with sort of more liberal groups who are concerned about, you know, the civil rights of the people who are getting affected, who are by and large, in a lot of these places happen to be poor or minority, because they're less likely to fight.
Yeah, you know, it's I can tell you, and this story and Reason has to be at least 20 years old. It could even be more. But Michelle Malkin, the firebrand conservative, Republican friendly radio host, and all of that, she actually wrote a piece for Reason when she was working. I think it was at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or the Seattle Times. About a case where a woman's house was seized because her son or grandson was accused of being a drug dealer. She obviously had no idea what was going on. So, I mean, these are stories have been percolating for a long time. I guess they've reached a boiling point where people are just like, that's, you know, they're like Popeye the sailor. That's all I can take. I can't take no more. More power to them. How is law enforcement reacting? Is there a uniform or an orthodox response of saying, like, hey, go screw yourselves, this is what we're going to be doing? Or is it more nuanced than that?
I mean, generally law enforcement, the major law enforcement organizations are in favor of asset forfeiture. And there's cases where they support some modest reforms. You know, they're not totally against transparency requirements and things like that. But where they really come down in opposition is things like some of the state level reform bills require getting a criminal conviction before you can seize something, which basically abolishes civil asset forfeiture if you have to get a criminal conviction. And that's where you see the opposition really come in, because it really affects their bottom line. The Justice Department doles out hundreds of millions of dollars a year through what's called the Equitable Sharing Program, where local law enforcement works with the feds on joint drug task forces, and they send the money that they get back to this big pool, and they get 80% of it back.
And this is like a bizarro world version of the NFL's revenue sharing, you know, where like Green Bay, you know, which has a puny local television revenues or something, gets some of New York's revenue, and New York gets some of the merchandise out of, or, you know, or Tampa Bay or something gets the merchandise rights. So in Texas, and again, to bring it back to the, you know, kind of this moment just yesterday where Donald Trump wanted, you know, he threatened to destroy the career of the state senator who was pushing, you know, can you believe it? He was like rolling his eyes, asset forfeiture reform. One of the things that was interesting about that was that there are at least four state senators who the sheriff who was talking could have been referring to, because it is, you know, actually it's a very popular bill that's working its way through the Senate. In Texas, in 2011, they did an asset forfeiture reform bill. What is the likelihood that asset forfeiture will be stymied? We know that Jeff Sessions, who is, the attorney general in waiting, is a big proponent of using civil asset forfeiture. He's very anti-drug war, or he's very anti-drug, pro-drug war. Who is going to win this battle over reforming civil asset forfeiture laws?
I mean, at the federal level, it's really tough, because the Justice Department controls the Equitable Sharing Fund, and it's very, very popular among law enforcement. So if you're a congressman, you don't want your local DA and you don't want your local sheriff mad at you, because they can really stir up a lot of resentment. You know, they can cause trouble for you politically. So it's a lot harder lift in Congress to get some of this stuff done. At the state level, though, you're really seeing there's dozens of states who have either passed some sort of reform or are introducing reforms. Texas, like we were just talking about, Texas has bills going through. The one that Trump got mad about, or the one that the sheriff asked him about, would have required a conviction for asset forfeiture. The problem with it is DOJ can sort of strong arm states. They did this to California when California was trying to pass a really aggressive civil asset forfeiture reform bill. They basically threatened to withhold all of their equitable sharing funds from California law enforcement because it would have redirected asset forfeiture into the general state fund instead of to the local police departments. So the DOJ has a lot of leverage in some of these cases, but they can't, you know, they can't do a lot to this at the state level. Which is where you're seeing a lot of the reform movement sort of going on. At the federal level, I would not put any money down on seeing asset forfeiture reform go through Congress anytime soon.
What about in the broader sense of criminal justice reform at the federal level or at the national level? One of the things that came out of cases like Ferguson, and I realize a lot of people, including a lot of libertarians, will say, that wasn't about police brutality. It was about, societal dysfunction or whatever. But there's no question that it touched off a serious conversation, a serious national conversation that people like Rand Paul, Justin Amash, a number of other Republican, libertarian-leaning, conservative-leaning conservatives, as well as a lot of kind of progressive liberals who had been looking the other way to have a serious conversation about criminal justice reform, about sentencing reform, about figuring out what are the disparities both of, you know, what are the disparate impacts of policies that were not intended to be racist, but what are the disparate impact, as well as what are the effects on the communities that are, you know, kind of down the downstream from all of that. Is the criminal justice kind of reform movement at the national level, with Donald Trump running and winning as a law and order candidate, Hillary Clinton, who is very slow to talk about Ferguson and is was kind of also a law and order candidate, is criminal justice reform more broadly dead at the federal level, do you think?
Yeah, the federal level, I don't know. I don't know what you'll see. There still might be some criminal justice measures that were more palatable to Republicans that you might see go through, like mens rea reform, which is kind of an in the weeds issue, but it's basically amending the criminal code to add intent requirements, because there's thousands of federal regulations and most of them don't require you to know that you were breaking them to be charged with breaking them.
Right. And this, though, the kind of progressive response to that is that, oh my God, that's like the Koch brothers, because, you know, if you have a mens rea component, meaning that you need to know you're breaking a law in order to be fully guilty of breaking the law, then that means corporations can say, oh, we didn't know that we were breaking the law by, you know, poisoning all the water and, you know, feeding plutonium to kindergarten kids.
Yeah, the liberal groups like Center for American Progress and oppose it pretty heavily, that that will let white collar criminals go free. And the sort of libertarian conservative argument is that, you know, we're stopping fishermen from getting sent to jail for accidentally catching one too many fish or throwing away fish, you know.
Or that it's kind of, you know, you go going back to common law and whatnot, you know, that, yeah, you know what, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, if you don't know that you're breaking the law, you know, it's not the same thing as if you go out of your way to do it. But that's a big sticking point, right, in the at the federal level for some of the criminal justice reform.
Yeah, it kind of actually scuttled. I mean, it caused a lot of tension. There was a sort of kumbaya moment in Congress where everyone thought Republicans and Democrats might have a pretty good deal going. And then when mens rea got introduced, the Democrats started to break off a little bit and it slowed things down. It was election year anyway, so I don't think criminal justice reform bills would have gone anywhere, but it showed there were more cracks than people thought in you know, Congress's little bipartisan moment. At the state level, though, I want to go back to this because we were talking about the national level. The state level, you're actually seeing a lot of movement, and there's going to be more. All of the major criminal justice advocacy groups are moving their attention to the states. The ACLU is launching a 50-state project to try and reduce incarceration by 50% across the country, which is sort of an insane goal, to be honest. It's a huge, huge task, and it would require releasing a lot of violent offenders. But there are major things going on with things like bail reform and court fines and fees. You mentioned Ferguson. Ferguson is what sort of popped everything off, and a lot of it had to do with punitive fees and fines and sending people to jail for unpaid fines and things like that. Well, since Ferguson, since 2 years ago when things really went down in Ferguson, municipal court revenues dropped from $54 million to $29 million in 2016. So they've actually reduced their amount of fines and fees that they're collecting by half.
And there's more than a few cities and municipalities around the country, I mean, that are, you know, I mean, that was not, you know, they were banking on that, right, as revenue to run their, you know, their day-to-day operations, which, again, is similar to the idea of cops getting to keep the assets that they seize. You know, if a municipality, you know, kind of writes into their budget that we're going to have this many speeding tickets, we're going to have this many missed court appearances, you know, these are problematic for, you know, for cities to have rules like that or expectations like that.
No, it's basically a revenue collection scheme. And, you know, and when people can't pay, they get sent to jail. And even if you're only in jail for 10 days, it can have a really negative impact on your ability to keep a job, You know, if you have kids, you have to arrange what to do with them. It's a massive, massive hassle if you get sent to jail just for having an unpaid court fine.
Or even being arrested. This always drives me nuts when conservatives in particular, you know, when, you know, and I've been working at Reason long enough where I get into a lot of these conversations, but you'll say to people, well, you know, there's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million arrests for marijuana possession, simple possession a year. And people will say like, oh, but, you know, nobody actually goes to jail for that. Nobody really gets charged or anything. But it's, you know, it is a massive disruption in a lot of people, in anybody's life, to actually be arrested and to be brought down to a police station, et cetera. That can, you know, and most people don't have a cushion. They don't have a couple of days vacation. They don't have extra cash laying around. I don't want to say it's a good thing because it's a shame that it's all happening, but I think it's a positive development that more Americans are becoming aware of how the criminal justice system operates, often, you know, far beyond what is necessary to keep us safe in our homes and our property.
Yeah, and one of the big things that's coming around is you're seeing a lot of groups that are starting to focus on what they call the front end of the justice system. That is, what happens to you in a police encounter, or what happens to you when you go to trial? Are you held, are you released on your own recognizance, or are you held on bail? Those are the sort of things that can actually have really big differences on the outcome of, a lot of these cases and people's future encounters with the criminal justice system. If you can keep someone from getting arrested in the first place, or get them release them and don't put them in jail for a week while they're awaiting trial, you can actually significantly improve their chances of not going to prison in the future. So that's what a lot of criminal justice groups are focusing on right now, in lieu of the really hard problem of how do we get more people out of prison.
And it's fascinating, I know, with the bail requirements and whatnot, you know, that it turns out when you do, you know, empirical assays of, you know, does bail keep people from skipping or anything? In many cases, it really serves no function other than as a kind of revenue generator.
Yeah. And in some states, a lot of states are getting rid of this. I think Illinois or Cook County in Chicago might have recently done this, but they used to have a 10%. You had to basically pay 10% on your bail to get out. And if you couldn't, say if you had a, you know, if you had a $5,000 bail and you couldn't make that 10%, then you'd go to jail and be held in the Cook County Jail, which is not a nice place.
Right. And that makes it more likely you're going to cut a deal, or you're going to do whatever you need to. You're going to snitch. You're going to do. I mean, it sets up so many perverse incentives. CJ, thanks for talking. Before we go, you have had a pretty fascinating career. You are not a criminal. You're not a criminal who became a justice reporter, at least not as far as we could tell when we did an extensive background check when you joined Reason a while ago. But you've worked at places like BuzzFeed and Vice. You've written for Vanity Fair. Talk a little bit about where you're from and why you're interested in criminal justice issues.
Well, I'm originally from Oregon. Well, I was born in Texas and moved to Oregon when I was a little kid, and pretty boring, really. I went to University of Oregon and I studied journalism, and I got out to D.C. and started doing some reporting. And, you know, politics was never sort of horse trail or horse race politics, and Hill reporting wasn't never sort of my thing. And I've always enjoyed stories about the people who are basically screwed over by the government. I always thought those were the stories I wanted to write. And around the time I started reporting a lot was when the criminal justice reform movement in Congress started building a lot of steam, and I started writing about that and reading more about what they're doing. And, you know, I realized that the criminal justice system is the place where the government has the most power to screw people over. Prosecutors have almost unlimited power in deciding, you know, what charges you get. They can argue for more bail. They have really just an incredible amount of power and no limits, and almost no limits on it.
Yeah. And on the resources, I remember I was living in Los Angeles when the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, and people kept saying, you know, it's unfair. O.J. is so rich, he can just buy more defense attorneys. And I think it was actually our Reason colleague, Brian Doherty, he was like, yeah, you know, that's funny because the state literally has unlimited resources to prosecute. And they spent, you know, as more money than anybody had ever had in a criminal trial at that.
Well, that's right. You know, if you want to file a lawsuit against the government, good luck, because they can draw it out as long as they need to, because they have unlimited money. You know, and that's, I guess that's why it really drew me to the criminal justice beat, was sort of this gargantuan task of trying to hold the government accountable and make it, you know, some semblance of fairness, I would say, for people trying to actually challenge it.
Well, I am glad to be working alongside of you, and I always read your articles with great interest. We have been talking with C.J. Saramella. He's Reason's own criminal justice reporter, and we've been talking mostly about asset forfeiture reform, but a lot of other issues that touch on the criminal justice system. C.J., thanks for talking to us.
Always a pleasure.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.